Well, let me begin today with a little bit of an experiment. I want you to think of the last time that you saw the news. Maybe it was a TV news program. Maybe it was a newspaper, if you are the kind of person who still buys newspapers. Or maybe it was some online news source. Just to kind of bring to mind the last time that you saw or you read the news. You're welcome to close your eyes if that would help. It's always a bit worrying to get people to close their eyes. There's always a danger that people are going to nod off during the sermon anyway. And I don't want to sort of risk my luck. But if you would find it helpful to close your eyes, please do. Okay, as you bring to mind the last time you saw the news, can you remember what the lead story of that news program or that newspaper or whatever it was happened to be? What was the lead story? And if you're able to manage to remember that, can you remember what the main argument of the news reporter or the journalist who wrote or delivered that piece was? What was the point that they were making? I imagine for most of us, that's a bit of a struggle. It's quite hard to recall that kind of information, though we're influenced by the news that we take on board. So let me try a different experiment. Let me try something else. Again, you're welcome to close your eyes if that would be helpful. This time, think of the last novel that you read or last film that you saw. And as you bring that to mind, think about what happened during that story. What was the main plot line? What were the big things that happened to the hero in the course of the story? Okay, open your eyes if you're the kind of person who closes your eyes. You don't want to risk things any longer than that. But I wonder how you found those two exercises. I would imagine that most of us, if not all of us, found the second exercise a lot easier than the first. We take in information, we take in news items as we go along, but we find it difficult to recall the sort of arguments and the information easily. But stories are different, aren't they? Stories are powerful. There is a power to stories. They stick in our minds. They get under our skin. They engage our imagination. And because of that, stories are able to shape and mold us, direct and influence us in powerful and lasting ways. And because of that, it shouldn't surprise us that Jesus used stories. He knew the power of stories and he used them often. And Jesus' teaching was often in parables. And as we read parables like the one we have before us in Matthew chapter 20 today, we find that Jesus uses those parables to challenge and confront his listeners. Jesus' stories divided. They divided people into two camps. They divided people into those who longed to know more of the kingdom those stories spoke of, those stories represented, and those who dismissed them as just mere stories. Perhaps great entertainment, fascinating storyteller in Jesus, but no more than that. So as we approach this section from Matthew chapter 20 today, as we get to listen in to one of Jesus' stories, we need to be mindful not to skim over this as an entertaining but mere story. But rather, we need to ask God to give us ears to hear the power and challenge behind this parable. Because I want to say that this story before us today is a very powerful story. Let's look at it together. Do look down to your Bibles. And the first thing I want us to realize is that this story in Matthew chapter 20 flows very much from what has come before it. We saw last week that Jesus gives this explanation of the cost of what it means to be his disciple at the end of chapter 19. He has an encounter with a rich man, and he helps the rich man to understand what it means to give things up to follow Jesus and to be his disciple. All of that discussion causes Peter to comment in verse 27 of chapter 19 with these words. He says to Jesus, "We've left everything to follow you. What then will there be for us?" Come on, Jesus, what can we look forward to? We've left everything behind. We've left our fishing business. We've left our families. What lies in store for us? And Jesus goes on in verses 28 and 29 of that chapter to outline the riches of the kingdom. But he ends chapter 19 with a very enigmatic phrase in verse 30. He says, "But many who are first will be last, and many who are last will be first." And you may have noticed, as Tim read for us, that that phrase is repeated again at the end of this parable. In verse 16 of chapter 20, Jesus says, "So the last will be first, and the first will be last." And in between, he tells a story that is sandwiched between those two lines about the last being first and the first being last. So we can see that this is a story that is intended to teach us what Jesus means by that line. It is a story, a parable, about the upside-down, topsy-turvy values of God's kingdom. And Jesus starts the story like this. "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard." For the disciples and the crowd that no doubt was gathered around as well, who were hearing Jesus tell this parable, that picture of a vineyard would have been a very familiar picture to them. Not just from the vineyards that would have been scattered around the local geography, but because the Old Testament speaks again and again about God's people as a vineyard and God as the vineyard owner. So here, as Jesus weaves this story, he pictures again God as a landowner, or more literally, as he says later in the parable, as Lord of the vineyard. Here is a parable about God, the vineyard owner. And what transpires teaches us about God's attitude to his people. And what we find happens is this. It is harvest time. The grapes are ready to be picked, everything's in place, and workers are needed to come and work in the vineyard, to gather in the crop, to get those grapes ready to be made into wine. And so what the vineyard owner does is he heads down to the marketplace in the center of town. In the Jewish culture of the day, the marketplace would have been the equivalent of the job center. It's where men looking for work, especially those looking for manual labor, would gather there at the start of the day to see if someone might need their services and hire them for their work. That's where they would go and they would seek for work to be done. And so we're told that as this vineyard owner needs to find people to do this work, so he heads to that place in the center of town to find people. And we're told that the vineyard owner goes down there to the marketplace early in the morning. Most likely it was before dawn. That time of the day in the hot desert climate where it was still cool and he could hire people to work before the sun came up, before labor became much harder in the heat of the day. So right at the beginning of the day, off he goes into the marketplace to see if there are people there he can hire to start work in his vineyard. And sure enough, as he goes to the marketplace, there are men gathered waiting for work, and he hires them to work for that day. Verse 2 tells us a very important fact, which is that they agree to work for a denarius. The contracts are drawn up, information is put together, negotiations are made with the union, and it is a denarius that they agree to work for. And that is a pretty fair wage, if not somewhat generous. If you look down to the bottom of your page in the NIV Bibles, you'll find a little footnote that helpfully tells you that a denarius was the usual daily wage of a day laborer. So this is a fair price. Depending on the work that will be done, it might even be a fairly generous price. But it's a price that's agreed on. Everyone signs on the dotted line, and the workers' union is happy, and off they go to start work in the vineyard at the break of the day. Well, as we find out more about this story and as it goes on, we find there is still plenty of work to be done. And so when the third hour of the day, which is 9 a.m., comes around, the vineyard owner finds that he still needs people to do work. So off he goes back to the marketplace to see if there are more people that he can hire. And there he finds some men hanging around with nothing to do. These are presumably the guys who forgot to set their alarm in the morning. They didn't get up for the 6 a.m. call to start work. But they're there by 9. That's pretty good. Had a cup of coffee, ready to go. And they are looking to see if there's anyone who would hire them. They've missed the prime opportunity at the start of the day, but there might still be work to be had. And sure enough, the landowner has plenty to do. So he hires the lot of them. And verse 4 tells us he agrees with them to pay whatever is right. Literally, he says, "I will pay you whatever is righteous." So he says, I will do the right thing by you. And no doubt in their minds, they would have thought, well, that's probably a little less than a day's wages. We weren't there by six. We haven't been able to contribute to that start of the day where presumably lots of work got done in the cool of the day, but we could still get a good amount done. We'll get a decent wage and be able to feed our family. So that's being okay with them. They agree and head off to work in the vineyard. Well, the story goes on. The day goes on. And we see, again, the vineyard owner heading back to the marketplace at noon. Now, to be honest, this is frankly getting a little bit silly. Noon was the hottest part of the day. Anyone who was going to be hired surely would have been hired already. And it would be hard work to start that manual labor in the blazing noonday sun. And I wonder if the vineyard owner, as he headed to the marketplace, thought, well, there's still work to be done, but I doubt that I'll find anyone there. But there he does. He still finds people in the heat of the day, no doubt trying to find some shade to hide under, ready and able to be hired for work. And so he brings them in to the vineyard as well. And then he goes back again at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and does exactly the same thing. And the story goes on until we get to verse 6, and we find the owner of the vineyard walking back to the marketplace once more, this time at 5 in the afternoon. Now, frankly, from an employment practices point of view, this is utterly crazy. For the time of the culture of the day, the normal working hours would be 6 a.m. in the morning to 6 p.m. in the evening, certainly for manual labor. And as the owner of the vineyard goes to the marketplace, he has only 1 hour's work left to offer anyone. I mean, surely you begin to think, well, is it really worth the paperwork to hire anyone at this point? I mean, think of all the tax information you're going to have to gather. I mean, surely it's just easier not to do the hiring. But he has work left to do, and off he goes to the marketplace, and sure enough, there are people still there. They haven't been hired. Nobody wanted them. They're on the edge of things, but here is the vineyard owner. And he says to them, come and work in my vineyard. He hires them too, and they head off to the vineyard for the final hour's work. Well, finally, evening comes around. And it is time to dish out the wages for the workers. Again, this might seem a little bit strange to us in our modern working framework, because we might think, well, surely it would make sense to just accumulate everything and pay them at the end of the month. I mean, that's much easier, isn't it? It's much easier for our accounting. Payroll services get a much lighter load. Surely that's the way to do it. But actually, what the vineyard owner are doing here is doing exactly what the Old Testament law tells him to. Both in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, God's people are told to give a worker their wages at the end of the day so they have money to go and buy food for their family so that they can eat. So the owner of the vineyard does what is right by the law, and he calls his workers in to give them their pay. And he decides to call them in for their pay packets in reverse order. He puts those who are hired first at the end of the line, and he brings those who are hired last. Those who are hired at 5 o'clock get to come in first. And then we come to verse 9. And we come to, frankly, the shock and surprise of the story. Jesus' parables always have a twist in the tale. They have a shock that we need to see, and the shock for us is in verse 9. You see, as that long line of laborers waits to get their pay, and as the first lot, those who are hired last, come into the office and they meet with the payroll person and they're given their payroll packets, you can imagine what they were thinking. Well, we've only done an hour's work. It's been profitable, don't get me wrong, but we haven't done as much as anyone else. We're just expecting perhaps a little bit of payment, a few pennies, but enough to be able to buy a morsel or two for the family so we have something to eat tonight. Well, you can imagine their surprise as they get handed their pay packets and they rip them open, and inside they find that each one of them has been given 1 denarius, a full day's wages. And I wonder how they responded to that. Maybe some thought, right, quickly, let's get out the door and get going before anyone notices the mistake. Surely someone's going to realize that we haven't done enough work to earn this, but just in case, let's get going and start spending the money before anyone can ask for it back. Maybe one or two are a bit more honest and they sort of sidle up to the person giving out the pay and say, do you realize what you've done? we got hired at 5 o'clock and you've given us a denarius. Surely something is wrong. Maybe you need to look at your records again. But the owner of the vineyard is clear. That is your wages. Take your pay. Well, no doubt as those who were hired last come out of the office and make their way, news of what they have received begins to filter back to the end of the queue. Those who are hired first start to get wind of what has happened, and they start doing maths in their head. It takes an extraordinary situation for you to start doing maths in your head, but this is what happens. They hear what has happened. Those who are hired last got one denarius. Well, let's think now. They did 1 hour's work. We did 12 hours' work. So if you do that, carry the one, we should get 12 times as much. So if they got one denarius, we should get 12 denarii. This is going to be a wonderful payday. We're going to be rich. This is so exciting. You can imagine that going through their head as they enter into the office, as they excitingly open their pay packets and find what is inside. One denarius. The same as everyone else. And so they start grumbling. Hang on. That's not fair. We work far harder than those who were hired last. They got an easy ride. They just rocked up at 5 p.m. The sun was going down. It was nice and cool. Frankly, there was very little work left to do. They were just clearing up as we'd done all the hard work. And who was there in the heat of the day? Who was there when the sun was blazing down? We were. This isn't fair. We deserve more. And as we reach this point in the story, maybe you sympathize with them. I imagine we would, wouldn't we? The Christian author Jerry Bridges tells of how he would tell this parable to business leaders and then afterwards ask them if they thought the owner was being unfair. And almost all of them would say, yes, that's not how you do things. That's not how we would operate our businesses. We instinctively think that we should treat people fairly and they should get what they deserve. A fair day's work deserves a fair day's pay, doesn't it? So listen to these words from the 19th century philosopher Thomas Carlyle. He says, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, it is as just a demand as governed men ever made of governing. It is the everlasting right of man. We know that, don't we? Here is a situation where you expect things to be different. And the vineyard owner has been the one who said he would do what is right by them, but he doesn't seem to be doing that at all. But it's important for us to see that Jesus doesn't tell this story to teach us about economic policy. This is not a parable about employment practices. It is rather a parable about God's generous grace. You see, the owner isn't being unfair at all to those who were hired first. He points that out himself in verse 13. They got a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. They got exactly what they agreed on in the first place. They signed on the dotted line. They agreed to do a day's work and get a day's wages, a denarius. No, the owner is not being unfair on the ones who were hired first. He is being unfair on the ones who were hired last. He is being gloriously and wonderfully unfair. Because he chooses to be generous. He can do whatever he likes with what he owns, as he says in verse 15. And he chooses to do what he likes by being lavishly generous to those who simply do not deserve it. And do you see that the point of Jesus' story is, I think, wonderfully clear. Here is a generous God who loves to give good gifts to those who simply do not deserve it. That, says Jesus, is what God is like. And I wonder if that's a surprise to you. Maybe it's a shock to you. Perhaps you've grown up thinking that God is a hard taskmaster, trying to sort of whip out of you every last bit of effort that you've got, or some kind of harsh school teacher looking over you, marking you down on everything that's gone wrong. But here is a picture of a God who is wonderfully generous, who chooses to be generous, and who chooses to be generous to those who do not deserve it. Let me say to you, if this is new to you, if this understanding of who God is something you've not come across before, let me urge you to come along to that Life Explored course starting tomorrow evening. It's exactly the kind of thing that we'll be looking at as we think about who God is, what he has done, what he is like. Please do come along. We'd love to see you there. But here in this parable, the theme is clear, I think. It is God's generous grace. But then the question is, what does it have to teach us today? What should we take away from this? Is this just a story about God's generous grace, which would be wonderful in itself? Or is there something that actually is supposed to challenge us? Well, I think there is. Just as we thought before about how we mustn't just dismiss this as a lovely story that entertained us for a while, but Jesus tells these stories to challenge, so we need to hear the powerful challenge of these words. Now, let me say, as I've been preparing this sermon this week, I was really struggling with this question, really trying to work out, what does this mean for me? What does it mean for us today? And I was chatting this through with Ali Gledhill, who's one of our apprentices this year, and as we were talking through this passage, he said something to me that really revolutionized my understanding of this parable. He said this very simple question: who do you identify with in this story? Who do you identify with? Now, that's a terrific question to ask of any Bible passage, and especially of any parable. But I think it's tremendously helpful to unlock the challenge of this particular story. Because you see, as I thought about this, I realized that we are supposed to identify with those workers who are hired last. You see, they are the ones who are shown lavish generosity. They are the ones who have done, frankly, nothing to merit their reward. They are the ones who are wholly dependent on God's grace and goodness. They're the recipients of God's generous grace. But the thing is, I don't think those are the people that we naturally identify with. I think in this story, we naturally identify with those who are hired first. You see, we so easily respond as they did in verse 12, don't we? We think instantly about the things that we have done, the things that we have given, all the effort we've put in, all the work that we've done, and we come to God so easily as those who are entitled. How often is our prayer something along the lines of, God, please be good to me because I deserve it? Oh, we may not use those words, but we certainly can have that attitude. Just as Peter said to Jesus, we've left everything to follow you, so what's in it for us? So we want God to know all the things that we have done, all the things that we have given, all the things that we have left behind. We want God to give us his grace, but because of what we have given him in the first place. So Jesus tells Peter, he tells the disciples, he tells us this story. He tells us this story so that we understand that there is great reward in following Jesus. There is a place in God's kingdom, adoption as his child, eternal and abundant life. But none of it is what we deserve. None of it. None of it is on the basis of what we have done. None of it is something that we can feel or can argue that we are somehow entitled to. Because, says Jesus, the last will be first, and the first will be last. And we need to grasp that we are the last before we can even enter the kingdom. And we need to continue to grasp and hold on to the fact that we are the last and dependent on God's grace as we live out what it means to be part of that kingdom, as we live out what it means to be his disciple. In just a couple of weeks, it'll be October the 31st. And that day isn't just Halloween. It is also the 499th anniversary of the day that Martin Luther kickstarted the Reformation. He was moved to do so by the practice of the time of indulgences, which was really just an attempt to buy your way into God's favor. It's essentially a way of feeling entitled to God's grace, exactly as being addressed here in the story. And the way that he complained about this was to write down 95 theses, 95 points that he wanted to make, and nail it on the door of Wittenberg Church, which is kind of the equivalent today of posting something on Facebook and watching it go viral. Well, listen to three of those 95 theses that Martin Luther wrote. Here's the number 62. The true treasure of the church is the most holy gospel of the glory and the grace of God. But this treasure is naturally most odious, for it makes the first to be last. And on the other hand, the treasure of indulgences, or feeling that we are entitled to God's goodness, is naturally most acceptable, for it makes the last to be first. By which Luther is not really meaning quite the same way that Jesus used it here, but he's talking about that attitude of entitlement reverses the order of God's kingdom and thinks of grace as something that we deserve. So says Jesus here, do we see the goodness and grace of God in Jesus Christ as our true and wonderful treasure? Or do we want something that is more naturally acceptable to us, where we can come to God on our own terms? Are we so shackled to our sense of entitlement that our time or effort or energy that we give to God is the basis for our acceptance with him, rather than the free grace of Jesus Christ? You see, Jesus issues us here, as we read this story, a deep challenge. He asks us, are you a firsty or a lasty? Are you one who thinks of themselves as first, or are you someone who thinks of themselves as last? And that's a tough thing to ask ourselves. So Jesus, as we finish, gives us two ways to diagnose our attitude from this story. Here's the first. You see, those who think of themselves as last respond to life with gratitude. Those who think of themselves as first respond to life with grumbling. So do you find yourself grumbling more than giving thanks? It's easy to do, isn't it? If so, it might be a sign that you have slipped into thinking of yourself as first instead of last. Do you find yourself praying something that essentially boils down to, God, it's not fair. I deserve this. I've done so much for you, God. Why won't you give me this one thing? Now, don't get me wrong, God is big enough to take those prayers from us. But he wants us to see those prayers and expose the attitudes of our hearts and make us aware how easily we slip into thinking of ourselves as first and entitled rather than last and given grace. You see, grumbling comes from thinking that we deserve more than we get. Grace and gratitude tells us that we get far more than we deserve. And if you find yourself prone to grumbling, if you catch yourself throughout this week moving towards that grumbling place, come back again to the cross of Jesus Christ. Remember again that what we truly deserve is God's wrath and punishment. And what he's given us is grace and forgiveness. Not what we deserve, but far more than we deserve. So do you respond with gratitude or with grumbling? Here's the second diagnosis. Those who think of themselves as last are content. Those who think of themselves as first are always comparing. Do you see the complaint of the workers in verse 12? Those who are hired last, they worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us. There's the heart of their complaint, isn't it? You've made them equal to us. Those who are first hate being equal to others. They love to compare themselves to others, to know that somehow they're better than others, to have a sense of self-satisfaction over others. The trouble, of course, that attitude is horribly damaging. American President Theodore Roosevelt once said, comparison is the thief of joy. And he was right. He was right. Here's how the 19th century Christian writer William Arnott explained this very parable. He says, see those two group of laborers as they wend their way home that evening. As to amount of money in their pockets, they are all equal. But as to amount of content in their spirits, there is a great difference. You see, the last go home, each with a denarius in his pocket and astonished, glad gratitude in his heart. Their reward, accordingly, is a denarius and more. But the first, on the contrary, go home, each with a denarius in his pocket and corroding discontent in his soul. And their reward, accordingly, is less than a denarius. So let me ask you, as Jesus does, do you have that corroding discontent in your soul? Do you find yourself again and again comparing yourself to others? Oh, they look so much better than I am. They've got everything together. They've got so much more than I do. They seem so much more sorted. Well, if that is you, perhaps that is a sign that you have slipped into thinking of yourself as first rather than as last. Because God's grace in the gospel puts to death any form of comparison. We are all equal. We all get the same. You see, I cannot say that I am better off than another because we have all received the denarius of God's grace. And I can never say that I am worse off than someone else either because we have all received the denarius of God's grace. God's grace is generous and it is equal. And so it puts to death comparison. So says Jesus, the last will be first, and the first will be last. Jesus tells us this story, this powerful story, to show God's generous grace, to help us understand that I cannot be first and I cannot be last because grace is freely available equally to all. But also to show that I cannot receive that grace unless I know that I can never deserve it. That I did not gain it, and I'm not entitled to it. Instead, just like those workers who are last, I receive it as the gracious gift of a generous God. Let me pray. Our loving Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are a generous God, that your generosity is so lavish and so free, as seen through the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. So give us hearts that are full of gratitude and keep us from grumbling. Help us by your grace not to compare ourselves with others, but fill us with the contentment that knows who you are and what you have given to us. Fill us with an understanding of what you have done. And may that give us joy each and every day. In Jesus' name, amen.